A recall effort is moving forward to oust two Democratic state lawmakers over their support for gun control laws. Benta Berkland is back from a maternity leave, and she has more from the state capitol.
Attorneys for Senate President John Morris and Senator Angela Jaron argued that the petition signatures collected for their recall were invalid because of a wording technicality. But Judge Robert Hyatt ruled against them, saying supporters complied with election law and the state constitution. Eric Groves is with the El Paso Freedom Defense Committee, which is trying to recall John Morris.
We're ecstatic with the decision. It goes along with everything that we've believed throughout this process.
Kirsten Forseth is a consultant for Morris's campaign and says he stands by his stance on guns.
He spent the last 7 years at the legislature. He wants to be judged by his entire record, not just a few votes. And if every time somebody, especially a special interest, disagreed with his votes, we wouldn't have a lot of legislation that happens up at the Capitol.
Both Morris and Jaron would be the first lawmakers in state history to ever face a recall election. I'm Benta Berkland at the state capitol.
Today's episode of Western Slope Skies from the Black Canyon Astronomical Society explores the life of Henrietta Swan Leavitt, an early 20th century astronomer.
This is the second in a series on women in astronomy. In the early 1900s, Henrietta Swan Leavitt discovered a characteristic of certain variable stars that is still used today to measure astronomical distance. Henrietta Leavitt was born on the 4th of July, 1868. She graduated from what is now Radcliffe College and took her first course in astronomy as a senior. Her first job was a photographic plate analyst for Edward Pickering at the Harvard Observatory. Pickering called these analysts computers. They were all women. According to Pickering, they were better than men because they were meticulous, accurate, and to be honest, lower cost. Leavitt worked for 25 cents per hour for a 42-hour week. This equates to about $260 per week in today's dollars. Leavitt studied variable stars, which change brightness with time. After cataloging thousands of stars, Leavitt noticed that certain variables were brighter if they had a longer period. Although Leavitt did not use the term, this group became known as Cepheid variables. Leavitt published papers in 1908 and 1912 confirming the relationship between brightness and period of Cepheid variables. This established Cepheids as a standard candle that can be used to estimate distances. If you know the period, which can be observed, then you can estimate the brightness. In combination with other data, this brightness allows us to calculate distance. Leavitt died in 1921. Edwin Hubble often said that Leavitt deserved the Nobel Prize. A member of the Swedish Academy considered nominating Leavitt, only to find that she had died. If she had lived and been awarded the prize, she would have been only the second woman at that time to receive a scientific Nobel Prize. If you're interested in learning more about Henrietta Leavitt, read Miss Leavitt's Stars by George Johnson. The Montrose Library has a copy. You've been listening to Western Slope Skies, produced by members of the Black Canyon Astronomical Society. I'm Brian Cashin.
According to the Post-Independent, a thunderstorm on Wednesday caused a large mudslide over Gunnison County Road 3 outside of Marble, covering the road with 4 to 8 feet of debris. The Independent reports the afternoon storm and mudslide blocked off Marble's main road into town until about 11 p.m. when crews were able to clear one lane. Firefighters monitored the area as another storm began to approach, but eventually bypassed the area. After Republicans voted to remove a food stamps program from the National Farm Bill last week, one Colorado group has released a report claiming the bill's agricultural subsidy spending is wasteful. According to the Colorado Independent, the Colorado Public Interest Research Group released a report criticizing the spending and called on Congress to make reforms to the 2013 Farm Bill before approving it. The group's report noted that U.S. subsidies have supported junk food production to the tune of $19.2 billion since 1992. That figure is nearly the same House Republicans want to cut from this year's bill in food stamps funding. The report also says 3.8% of the nation's farmers have received some 75% of all agricultural subsidies, totaling around $292.5 billion. 62% of farmers, however, haven't received any of that funding. Critics claim such methods of subsidizing are misuse of taxpayer dollars and confuse the market. They also say the already profitable companies receiving the subsidies don't actually need them. According to The Independent, the debate over the Farm Bill's provisions comes at a time when the future of the nation's agricultural industry is anything but certain. As reported by The Independent, the USDA recently estimated that the average farmer's age is 57, with over half of farmers expected to retire in the next 10 years. While the farming community continues to age, fewer young people are filling the ranks, prompting the question, do young people even want to farm anymore?
The quick answer is yes, just not in the same numbers as they used to. And a lot of them don't want to farm in conventional ways. Case in point, meet Ava Teague.
So, do you want to take a walk around?
Those oinks are coming from the snouts of her 15 pigs rolling in a mud pit at her small farm outside Longmont, Colorado.
Water, shelter, grass, shade, mud, pretty much all they need.
Teague is a grad school dropout turned farmer, originally from the East Coast. Jaded with academia, she moved to Colorado and began working as a farm apprentice. She bought her first pigs a couple years ago.
Didn't have that much cash, so I paid for feed with the credit card just to get going.
Right now, her biggest challenge, like many other young farmers, is access to capital. Teague spends her days on the farm and every evening working full-time as a waitress. She lucked out and scored a lease for these 15 acres after searching for plots of land on Craigslist and taught herself QuickBooks through Google searches. In short, Teague is part of the millennial generation of farmers, a group that eschews traditional forms of agriculture and favors small-scale operations.
It's a very rare person who's not grown up on a farm and who's going to go out and say, I want to plant 100,000 acres of corn. I want to get a confinement hog barn with 300,000 pigs.
But the millennial generation isn't exclusively made up of farmers who've jumped on the local food movement. About 40 miles north, 25-year-old Bo Bigler is dropping feed off to cattle at a feedlot devoted to research.
And then these steers.
Bigler's graduating at the end of the summer with a master's degree in beef management, which almost ensures a career working at large feedlots. Bigler says owning his own ranch is out of the question.
Just because the price to buy into it, it's too much. The cost of land is unreal. I think the only way that somebody can get into it is if a ranch was handed down to them, unless they're, you know, millionaires to begin with.
That's another huge hurdle facing young people who want to get into agriculture, the high cost for land. A survey a couple years ago by the National Young Farmers Coalition showed access to land and capital to be the single biggest factors keeping young people from getting into farming or ranching. There's an interest in farming, but it can be difficult to turn dreams of a farm life into a reality.
The system is not working right now to allow them entrance into that job market.
Craig Peel is a professor of animal sciences at Colorado State University. He says within ranching, the need to bring in young people has reached a tipping point for both large and small operations. 64% of the nation's cattle ranches are owned by someone who's older than 55. Given the economic situation, many of Peel's students have chosen to forego the financial difficulties of running a ranch and work for large agribusiness companies instead.
There's no way they can pay the student loan and pay a land payment and still have enough money left over to live on. So it's very frustrating to a lot of these students that would like to do that, but economically it just doesn't make sense and it's just not feasible and the banks won't loan them money in the first place.
Back at Ava Teague's pig farm in Longmont, she's working on a multi-year business plan to make sure she can add on a few acres of vegetables and some more pigs.
I think a lot of young people want to work outside and sort of a farm camp fun experience. There are fewer people who would like to work really hard, like 60, 70 hours a week for not a lot of money, which is what working on a farm is.
Teague filled out a form for the latest agricultural census last year. When data is released in 2014, we'll see whether enough young people have joined the ranks to keep the average farmer age from climbing even higher. Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
And Harvest Public Media reports on farm and food issues. It's a collaboration of KUNC and other public media stations in the Midwest. You can find other stories or comment on this one at harvestpublicmedia.org. A meeting was held last night at the Paonia Town Hall to take public comments on an environmental assessment for a new Bowie coal lease by application. KVNF News Director Travis Bubenik attended the meeting. And so, Travis, fill us in on the details of this application and tell us what was discussed at the meeting.
So it was a very short meeting, called to order at around 6 p.m. and officially closed at 6:06. Barbara Shero, the field manager for the BLM's Uncompahgre field office, led the meeting. She outlined the details of the application. It's a proposed coal lease for lands managed by the BLM, Uncompahgre field office, and the Grand Mesa, Uncompahgre, Gunnison National Forest. It also includes some private lands. So of that land, around 1,800 acres is adjacent to coal leases Bowie already owns. 1,300 of those acres are national forest lands, 88 are BLM lands, and 368 acres are private lands with federal minerals. And according to the application, the estimates are that there could be around 8 million tons of recoverable coal in the area. The lands are all located about 5 miles northeast of Paonia. So Shero asked for comments from the few people there. There wasn't a lot of conversation, but Hotchkiss Mayor Wendell Kuntz, speaking on behalf of the interests of Arch Coal, also said that they recognize Bowie as a good operator and that the new coal reserves are not of economic interest to Arch Coal. A representative for Bowie said that the company will submit its comments in writing.
Mm-hmm. And now what's next?
Well, basically, the process is BLM has to now decide on whether to make the lease available through a competitive sale. And the Forest Service has to consent to that sale. And if it doesn't, it has to outline rules for protecting resources in those areas.
Great. Well, thank you. Thank you for that report, Travis. And thanks to that handful of folks who went to that Bowie coal meeting, and Barb Sherrow from the BLM, who was up here last night. That concludes the KVNF Local News.